This podcast contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Creepy Cannabis Podcast, where we chat all things creepy, cannabis, true crime, paranormal, and weird. I'm Madeline.
I'm Rachel. We're just really disappointed in ourselves today. We've been having a lot of technical difficulties. We're not going to bore you with those. We're going to carry right along.
Yeah.
But just know that...
I thought confidently that the last episode was fine, and it's because I black out the entire 50%, second half of every episode. I can't listen to them, so not when I'm posting it, and then it does turn out that it was not okay.
So. You know, at the end of the day, we're doing our best as humans. It's not great. That is the fattest joint I have ever seen in my life. She rolled a real fatty, guys. A real fatty. Tell us all about that.
I actually put some hash in this, which, and specifically, it's called a temple ball, which is, it's originated from, it originated before the modern, ice water extraction method. They were first made from hand-collected cannabis trichomes, or from dry sifting, separating the trichomes from the plant using screens. So, a lot of the stuff that you're going to get in your, kief.
Okay.
So, it's concentrated. And they are the original solventless cannabis concentrate. It's a way to store and preserve the precious trichome heads for, long-term preservation.
So, so they're made into these, actual ball shapes?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Oh, you have them? Stop. It looks like Play-Doh.
It's a little hash ball.
Oh, she's...
So you can kind of, sprinkle it on the joint.
Oh, I see. Guys, it's pretty cool looking. Yeah, it looks like a little brown Play-Doh chunk.
Yeah, and... hash coins and shit, that's, originally the only form of cannabis that there was in
that's
the
United
wild. States. Hash coins, hash and tinctures, and then Mexican immigrants introduced the smoked cannabis to America.
Well.
Heavily.
Thank you, because that's way more convenient.
Way more.
At this time in my life. At this juncture in my life, that's a better choice.
Traditionally, they were made by hand rubbing ripe cannabis flowers and collecting the trichomes that stuck to the skin.
Stop it!
Yeah. And this strain is called Scooby Pie.
That sounds yummy.
So it's a cross between Scooby Snacks and Georgia Pie, which Scooby Snacks is an indica dominant hybrid, cross between Platinum Girl Scout cookies and Face Off OG.
I do like Scooby Snacks. That one is good for sleeping.
Mm-hmm. And Georgia Pie is a hybrid strain. It's a cross between Seed Junkie, it's bred by Seed Junkie Genetics, and it's supposed to, smell and taste just like fresh peach cobbler, but it gives you a really intense head and body high, and it's supposed to be reserved for people who have very high THC tolerance. We'll see.
Yeah. Maddie is the one.
And it's also mixed with one of my favorite strains, which is called Dead Band 7.
Well, don't even let me catch that smoke, because you know my dumbass won't even be able to finish a line of this episode. I'll be like, once upon a time. It'll literally be like the episode we accidentally posted for an entire week. Just silence.
Oops.
It's not funny. Stop the tears. Sorry. What else about your...
That's fine.
Guys, I need to take a picture of it really quick for the gram. This is the don't worry, I won't get your person. Well, let me zoom in a little bit more. It's, look at it. Anyway, carry on. So
yeah, hash, it's an infused joint, if you will.
Yeah, so you added some of that to...
I just sprinkled it on.
the strain you just told us about. Perfect. Okay, guys. Well, we're getting right into it. We're going to be talking about Patriots Day, April 15th, 2013, which was a day just like any other day, just like today, until it wasn't. that was not a comedy. Just let it out. Just let it out.
Until it wasn't.
Guys, it's always hard to talk about these things. At 2:49 p.m. Eastern Time, two bombs detonated about 210 yards apart at the finish line of the 117th annual Boston Marathon on Boylston Street near Copley Square. The first bomb exploded outside Marathon Sports, which range between 671 and 673 Boylston Street. So multiple properties. And that bomb went off at 2:49 and 43 seconds. At the time of the first explosion, the race clock at the finish line showed 4 hours, 9 minutes, and 43 seconds. And that was the amount of time that had lapsed since the start of the third wave. So this, for those of you who don't know, the Boston Marathon is a huge, huge deal. It's a huge marathon. It's a very densely, highly populated event. And these marathons were run in these waves to account for all the various people that wanted to join. So this is the third wave at the time that this bomb went off, and that wave started at 10:40 that morning. So remember, the first bomb exploded at 2:49:43, which means 2 hours, 49 minutes, 43, or 2 p.m., 2:49 p.m., and 43 seconds. Mm-hmm. Sorry. The second bomb went off at 2:49:57 p.m., which was only 14 seconds later and only one block farther west at 755 Boylston Street. The explosions themselves actually took place nearly 3 hours after the winning runner had already crossed the finish line. Even with that said, there were still more than 5,700 runners yet to finish. So obviously, you know, that's spanned a much larger area, but that's still a lot of people, not including any of their loved ones, onlookers, anything like that. The people that live in the houses and businesses surrounding this, it's a very busy day for everyone, you know, a lot of income to be made. So windows on adjacent buildings, so across the way, were blown out, but there was no structural damage to the actual adjacent buildings. So that's to say, it was a very serious explosion. It stayed fairly local to where it went off. so, yeah, there's no structural damage. And runners actually continued to cross the finish line nearly 10 minutes later. They didn't stop until 2:57 p.m. Because, again, some of them were very far, but this was fairly close to the finish line. So there were still people that were just like doing their shit, going about their day. Like, it was wild. You remember, like, when this happened?
Yeah.
It was wild. Okay. I added a, like, actual mouse to the laptop thinking it would be easier, and it's just not helping.
Yeah.
So, rescue workers and medical personnel that, like, were already on hand as usual for the marathon, so they were able to start giving aid, like, immediately, as additional police, fire, and medical units were being dispatched. And that included surrounding cities as well as private ambulances from all over the state. I read through a list of all the people that, all the different, like, departments and things, and it was, like, local college police campuses, or campus police, everybody was coming to help. Mm-hmm. Guys, I shouldn't have taken that hit. I'm doing my best, but a bitch is fumbling.
I took one hit of that thing.
I took two hits. I'm not smoking the same thing as Maddie. I'm smoking something called Hell's OG, and that bitch is sending me for an experience. Anyway, let me figure out where I was. Yeah, so a bunch of people are coming from surrounding states. People immediately are trying to give care. Ultimately, the explosions killed 3 civilians and injured 281 people, about, give or take.
Jesus.
And those people were treated at over 27 local hospitals. So there were so many injured that they had to disperse them across 27 hospitals. Mm. At least 14 individuals required amputations due to damage they received, with some people suffering traumatic amputations as a direct result of the blast. And that literally means that their limbs were amputated by the blast. In fact, later we'll talk about the person who ended up giving the description had both of their legs traumatically amputated by the bomb. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct. police were following emergency plans. They diverted all remaining runners to Boston Common and Kenmore Square. There was a nearby hotel called the Lenox Hotel and other buildings surrounding the scene that were all evacuated. Immediately after the bombing occurred and medically injured people were transported. So after they came in, figured out who needed urgent care, actually transported anybody that needed to go to the various hospitals, the police closed down a 15-block area around the site. And then they were able to reduce that to a 12-block crime scene the next day. And I looked into that. That's just based on various factors, like how far they found debris, injury, whatever, where these people could have likely gone in that time, whatever. excuse me. What was I talking about? Where was I? Guys, it's really hard.
Yeah, block radius.
Down to 12. Okay. Boston Police Commissioner Edward F. Davis recommended that people stay off the streets. You know, nobody really knew what was going on. Why this had happened. Nobody had, like, claimed it at this point. You know, it was a shock. People were just, they were responding accordingly. There were drop bags and packages, like, everywhere. Obviously, as people fled from the blast, they dropped their shit. They were like, that's not important. But that unfortunately led to increased uncertainty as to the possible presence of more bombs. And they also got a lot more reports, you know, that were false. So it was hogging up the lines because people just weren't sure. And, you know, at the same time, they had to call them in. I would, because there's no way of knowing until each and every one is checked. But that's still, you know, resources that you don't want to be spending that way. Simultaneously, there was an electrical fire at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in a nearby area called Dorchester. And a lot of people were really concerned that it was another bomb, and it ultimately wasn't, but it was happening exactly at the same time, and everyone was just freaking out and really worried. So, you know, because you're trying to figure out, is this an isolated incident? Is this the next September 11th? Are we in a terror attack? You just don't know. Mm-hmm. The airspace over Boston was restricted, and departures were completely halted from Boston's Logan International Airport, which is a very high-traffic airport, by the way. I looked that up. And then some local transit services were halted, obviously, as needed. The Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency suggested people trying to contact those in the vicinity use text messaging instead of voice calls because of crowded cell phone lines. Cell phone service was very congested, but it did, remain open. You know, it didn't cause anybody to not be able to make calls, but for like a brief moment, there was like some rumor that they shut them down because a phone was used to detonate the bombs, but nothing like that ever actually happened. I will say, and I've talked about it before, when we had that aftershock from the earthquake that happened, I can't remember where it happened, but, immediately after, I tried to call my mom to see if she was okay, and you couldn't make a single phone call. Everything just was a busy signal. Mm-hmm. And that was from a non-catastrophic natural disaster that was, like, barely a thing.
When I lived in New York, and you can still find pictures of it to this day, it was honestly the fucking craziest thing ever. It was just a storm. But all of the trains leaving Grand Central were shut down completely for hours. So I get off work, and I'm ride the subway right into Grand Central Station, and then you walk up and then over to the trains, and like,
oh, so you didn't even know.
When the doors opened at the subway station, the platform was packed, and I had to push my way up the stairs, and it was, if anyone's seen pictures of Grand Central Station, shoulder to shoulder the entire building, there were 50,000 people in the train station.
And isn't that, for people who haven't, it's a very big open space. It's like a huge open...
Yeah.
Like, I've seen it in I don't think I've ever seen it in person, to be honest with you, but I've seen it in a couple of films, and it's not small.
No, it was so crazy. It must have been 2017.
Imagine 2018. When you have, like, more trains trying to come, and, like, you are a small person, you could barely get off the train.
Yeah, and it was insane. Look, this is a picture. I was there.
Oh my god.
I was there.
She's an introvert, guys. How did she live?
Fucking train. This is literally, like...
We should post a picture of this. It was crazy.
And terrifying. And then when they finally started running the trains again, I literally was trying to figure out how to get home. I ended up taking a $250 Uber upstate because they were not... Like, it was already 11.
You called me during this. Mm-hmm. You called me during this. And it was late as hell. And I was like, how are you going to get out of there?
Mm-hmm. So I ended up, my job actually ended up paying for an Uber because there were two of my other coworkers at the train station, too.
That's right. So you could all take at least a ride share.
And, yeah. And when they started doing, running the trains again, literally people were running and, like, pushing each other out of the way. And it was terrifying. And I almost died. It was like a stampede. It was like The Lion King.
Okay. This isn't funny, but... It reminded me of a funny story, and guys, I've tried to stay really on course the last couple episodes. I don't, you know, I stay on the episode, but this reminded me of the fucking funniest story, which is simultaneously the worst thing to ever happen to me. Mm-hmm. The very shortened version of All You Need to Know is that when my husband and I went to Thailand, we went there with his best friend and his wife, who is from Thailand. She is Thai. She has now dual citizenship. After being awake for 24 hours, partying in God knows where for who knows how long, and when I say 24 hours, I mean 24 hours of not sleeping. Mm-mm. We arrive at a base of a mountain, and I am told that we are going to climb this mountain. And at first I wanted to cry and laugh and do all the things, but then no, because they're taking us to a holy temple. So no, I have to be serious because, like, I'm not going to disrespect this holy culture.
No.
So as we are sitting 24 hours awake in what can only be described as the heat of actual hell.
Yes.
With the thickness in the atmosphere so dense that every step felt like I had 20-pound weights on my legs, arms, and body.
Okay.
I can do this. So realistically, here's what happens. We weren't supposed to be there. White people are not supposed to be there. But because we were there with our friend, they allowed it and everybody was very kind. But no one spoke English. We were stupid, mm-hmm. knew nothing. We are going through. They're teaching us how to do all the prayers, do all the things. And then we sprint. This is why this is important. We sprint to the back of a truck. The back of a truck. We are sprinting in the heat, right? I'm a big bitch. I don't sprint. A bitch is fucking sprinting.
I'm not a sprinter.
This is, guys, hang in with me. I promise it's worth it. So the way it's a literal pickup truck, but the frame of the pickup truck has, like, a bar that's, like, extra height that you can, like, loop your arms around to hold on. Mm-hmm. Are you following me as best you can? Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're all piled in, and at this point, they are driving this fucking car straight up a mountainside. The force of the angle at which we were speeding up the mountain, I swear to Christ, on my soul as I sit here, I flew out of the seat and was like, no, guys, picture it. My legs are in between everyone, dangling in the middle of the truck, and my arms are stretched as far as they can go above my head, clenching for dear life to a goddamn metal rod. I will die here, and everyone is looking at me like, if she goes, she's taking at least I'm drooling. As if to say, if she goes, she's taking at least two of us with her, and they're all scared. But guys, I'm serious. Like, I'm scared. Like, I'm hanging on. And Sean is holding one arm. And then the bar, like fucking Captain America, trying to hold the helicopter. It hurts. So, we finally, like, level out, and, like, when I say I dunk, like, onto the ground, and I clamber up back between the people, and I'm, like, now I'm bear hugging it, like, from the front, like, I turn around, I'm like, fuck that. So we get up here, we spend the rest of this day climbing this mountain. It was the hardest fucking climb of my life, straight up into the literal mountains of the goddamn jungle of Thailand.
No.
And then finally we get to the top, and it's so beautiful. And I'm like, all right. And we go back, and then there's a point again where the trucks pick you up again, because they take you like halfway up. Literally, the way you had to sprint for your spot. A bitch is dehydrated. A bitch is hungry. A bitch has had 5 near-death experiences already.
You have to fucking run.
And Kate looks at me in the eyes and she goes, when truck come, fast. Christ.
Cry.
Sorry, my do not disturb zone, but my husband went through it.
Cry.
Yes, so we sprinted, and when I tell you that I watched grown men and women rip the shirt collars of infants and yeet them off. It's like, all right, baby, church is over. Who gives a fuck about these things?
No.
And on the way down, everybody made me sit up against the tailgate because the pressure.
I'm done.
And that's all I needed to say. I'm sorry, but I had to tell that story to someone, because I need to write a book called One Time I Went to Thailand, because the amount of shit that happened on that fucking trip.
Jesus.
So now to bring you right back to misery. That all stemmed from people were trying to call some people, and it was...
Yeah.
Oh, spotty going through.
That didn't include my story is that none of the phones were working because everyone was calling each other.
It's what happens.
The whole point of the story.
When you have ADHD and you smoke, and instead of having a bad trip, like, you just have the best time. There?
And it was because I couldn't make any calls out of Grand Central to anyone.
I'm deceased. Oh my god, I actually laugh so hard I think I have a fucking 6-pack of abs.
It really hurts.
So, anyway. The American Red Cross did help concerned friends and family receive information about runners and casualties. The Boston Police Department set up a, like, cell phone hotline for people to provide information. And then Google Person Finder actually activated their disaster service under Boston Marathon explosions to log known information about missing people as a publicly viewable file. So, you know, as reliable as they could be a source of information, if you're just... There's thousands of people doing thousands of things. They don't have time to check and see if your mom or dad is there, you know. So this was a very invaluable resource for these people who were otherwise had no way of knowing if people were alive or dead. Due to the closure of several hotels near the blast zone, a number of visitors were left without anywhere to stay. And Boston area residents actually opened their homes to them, and people were just staying with strangers. They were just still not knowing who put the bomb here, if it's one person, multiple people, how it got there. People are just opening their homes and letting everyone stay there. They had nowhere to go. The Federal Bureau of Investigation led the investigation, and they were assisted by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the CIA, the NCC, and the DEA. It was initially believed by some that North Korea was behind the attack after escalating tensions and threats with the U.S. had been going on. United States government officials, though, were quick to shut that down and said that there had been no intelligence reports suggesting such an attack. Representative Peter King, who's a member of the House of Intelligence Committee, said, I received 2 top secret briefings last week on the current threat levels in the United States, and there was no evidence of this at all. So basically, as we all know, the government does not make us aware of who knows what high percentage of threats. If they did, we would be living in a panic state 24/7.
Oh, no. There's, like, this count in, what's the agency, like, Port Authority or something in New York. They run, like, all the trains and shit, and they have a count in their offices of how many, like, bomb threats there are, and it's a lot.
It's wild. So, you know, he basically was like, yeah, I got a couple credible things, none of which were related to this, so they just didn't feel that North Korea had anything to do with it, and that wasn't something they wanted to look any further into. So, evidence found near the blast sites included bits of metal, nails, ball bearings, black nylon pieces from a backpack, remains of an electronic circuit board, and wiring. So sorry. A pressure cooker lid. Oh. So sorry. The laugh got me. Was found on a nearby rooftop. Like a pressure cooker. One of those things. Every way I can think to describe it is, like, it cooks with pressure. I felt stupid. But if you've ever seen one of those videos of somebody, like, letting the steam out of one and it, like, blows the lid off and shoots into their ceiling. So they made these explosives, whoever made them, out of pressure cookers, most likely, based on this. So they found that on a lid of a nearby a roof of a nearby building. Authorities confirmed that the bombers used bomb-making instructions found in Al-Qaeda in Arabian Peninsula's Inspire magazine. Later, after the suspects were identified, the Boston Globe reported that they purchased fireworks from a fireworks store in New Hampshire as well. On April 19th, the FBI, West New York Police Department, and Hudson County Sheriff's Department seized computer equipment from the apartment of a suspect's sister in West New York, New Jersey. This is also a little bit jumbled up because it's talking about things once they're identified because it's relevant to the story now, but these things happened after they were identified. On April 24th, investigators reported that they had reconstructed the bombs and believed that they had been triggered by remote controls used for toy cars. Because I had mentioned earlier there was some panic as to whether or not the devices were triggered by cell phones. So, we've talked a little bit about the fact that they do have suspects, so what led to that? Earlier, I talked about a victim who suffered a traumatic amputation. So, Jeff Bauman was immediately adjacent to one of the bombs, so that means right next to it, essentially, and lost both his legs traumatically. He wrote while in the hospital, exactly. Bag, saw the guy, looked right at me. So he basically, in his trauma and shock, was trying to say, there was a bag, I saw the guy, he looked at me, I know, like, who they were. And later, when he was able to, he gave a detailed description of the suspects, which enabled images of them to be identified and circulated pretty quickly. Yeah. So sorry, I need a sip of this frosty Coca-Cola, please hold.
Yeah, that's crazy. He just straight sold.
He straight up had both legs blown the fuck off and was like, before I go down for surgery, I know who he is. Then awakened and was like, here's your description. Enjoy. Jeff, you're the real one for real. At 5:20 p.m. on April 18th, which was 3 days after the bombing, the FBI released images of two suspects carrying backpacks, asking the public's help in identifying them. The FBI said that they were doing this in part to limit harm to people wrongly identified by news reports and on social media. There was actually quite a few people that were, like, seriously looked into, and a lot, there's a whole movie about that, too, you can look into, about a person who was,
like, framed.
Yeah, essentially. So, as seen on video, the suspect stayed to observe the chaos after the explosions and then walked away super casually. So once they had their descriptions, they went, they looked, they found them, they watched them, caused the explosion, watched them, not react, and then leave. The public sent the authorities, like, a shit ton of photographs and videos, which were scrutinized by both authorities and online public social networks. It, again, a lot of things trying to be helpful can make a situation very confusing. At 10:48 p.m., nearly 6 hours after the photos were released, the Sarnoff brothers... I'm doing my best, guys. It's T-S-A-R-N-A-E-V. Sarnoff brothers.
Sure.
Ambushed and shot Sean A. Collier of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Police Department 6 times in an attempt to steal his Smith & Wesson M&P45 sidearm, which they could not free from his holster ultimately because of its security retention system. Collier was only 27 years old. He was sitting in his police car near a building on the campus and was just basically shot to death. He died soon after the shooting, unfortunately. And that made me really sad because, like, if you think about it, yes, real crime happens on campuses, but, like, these are campus police. Like, they're here to help after a tragic event. This man is sitting in his car. Just, it really bothers me when somebody's just minding their own business and gets just, like, attacked like that. I don't care what the circumstance. It just skeeves me out.
Mm-hmm.
That's one I don't like.
God, that'd be terrible.
They get what's coming to them. It's okay. The brothers then carjacked a Mercedes-Benz M-Class SUV in the Austin-Brighton neighborhood of Boston. One of the brothers, Tamerlan, took the owner, who was a Chinese national named Dun Danny Meng. He took him hostage and told him that he was responsible for the Boston bombing and for shooting the police officer. Zakhar, the other brother, followed them in the brother's green Honda Civic. So the one brother is with the hostage and the other brother is following behind them in their personal vehicle.
Okay.
Later, like, going to join them in the Mercedes. And later interrogations did reveal that at this time when all this was going on, the brothers had decided spontaneously that they wanted to go to New York and bomb Times Square. So as they're, like, abducting this man, telling him he's responsible, like, they're like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to gather up the rest of our shit and go bomb Times Square.
Okay.
The brothers forced Meng to use his ATM cards, and they got $800 in cash, equivalent to just a little more, about $1,000 as of 2022. They transferred objects to the Mercedes-Benz and carried on, again, with the one brother following in the Civic. Now, by this point, an all-points bulletin was issued for that car, so why they... I don't know. But the brothers then drove to a Shell gas station on Memorial Drive in Cambridge to fill up... You know, they had a long drive to Times Square to set off more explosives. But while one of the brothers went inside to pay for some junk food, Meng, fearing that they're probably going to harm him, if not worse, on the long drive... escaped, and he ran across the street to a mobile gas station and asked the clerk there to call 911. Luckily, he left his cell phone in the car, and that did allow the police to focus their search on the Watertown area, since they loosely knew where they were now, essentially, from tracking his phone. So they couldn't get, like, a pinpoint location, but they knew enough to get, like, a bulletin out to the town. Because it's like, yeah, it was just going off, like, cell phone towers and pinging the general. Shortly after midnight on April 19th, a Watertown police officer named Joseph Reynolds identified both brothers in the Honda and the stolen Mercedes after overhearing radio traffic that the vehicle was pinged, like, near him. He followed the vehicle while waiting for additional units to perform a high-risk traffic stop. When both suspect vehicles turned onto Laurel Street and stopped at the intersection of Laurel and Dexter. So, Tamerlan, the first brother, stepped out of the Mercedes, and he immediately opened fire on Officer Reynolds and Sergeant John McLellan, who both returned fire and requested emergency assistance over their radios. And then a Wild West gun battle ensued. Like, that was it. Everybody was going. So, Sarnave, the... officers and additional officers responding to the shots fire radio transmission, all were shooting, and over 200 or 300 shots were fired, which is wild to me. Okay. Because, like, I don't know, I'm not saying anybody's aim is bad, but there's two of them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of you. And 300. Yeah. The suspects, of those 200 or 300 shots, the suspects shot 56 times, detonated at least one pressure cooker bomb, and threw five crude grenades, three of which did explode. So all this is happening, by the way, at an intersection in a Boston neighborhood.
Well, that's lovely.
Imagine just, like, yeah, the busy street right down there, and there's just, like, a whole, I mean, here there probably would be. Anyway, the agencies involved in the nearly 7-minute shootout included the Watertown Police Department, Cambridge Police Department, Boston Police Department, Massachusetts State Police, Boston University Police, and MBTA Transit Police Department. Most of the officers involved were equipped by their respective agencies with their Glock 22 or 23. some agents were armed with Smith and Wesson pistols. And it allowed investigators to essentially match the 9mm casings and projectiles found at the scene to the suspect's 9mm Ruger P95 pistol. Because they knew, you know, obviously police weapons are tracked, so they knew whose was whose. So they had a 7-minute shootout. According to Watertown Police Chief Edward DeVoe, the brothers had an arsenal of guns. Timberland eventually ran out of ammunition. He was the older brother. So Timberland, who was in the Mercedes, right? Yes, he was in the Mercedes, who opened fire first, ran out of ammunition. He threw his empty Ruger pistol at Watertown PD Sergeant Jeffrey Puglias, who tackled him with assistance from a Sergeant McClellan. So he kept shooting at them until he ran out of bullets. When they realized he was out, tackled him. His younger brother, who was Zakhar, then drove the stolen SUV toward his brother and the police, who unsuccessfully tried to drag the brother out of the car's path and handcuff him. But he was run over and drug a short distance down the street, narrowly missing the officer. So he literally only ran over his brother. Sergeant McClellan later stated that the younger brother had thought they were doing CPR on another officer and tried to run them over. So maybe he didn't mean to hit him. I'm not really sure, but he definitely ran his brother over.
Jesus.
So Dakar abandoned the car half a mile away and fled on foot, but he was really badly wounded at the time. He was wounded at the time, and then his brother was badly wounded. He just got run over by a car, so for sure. So Tamerlan was taken into custody, but he died at 1:35 a.m. at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. So now one brother, the older brother, is deceased, and the younger brother is injured to a degree and is on foot. The Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority police officer Richard H. Donahue Jr. was critically wounded in the crossfire from the other officer shooting at the fleeing vehicle, but he survived. So he was shot by, like, a fellow officer. Reports revealed that his gunshot wound severed his femoral artery and he nearly died from bleeding to death. But there were some very fast-acting efforts by his fellow officers and medical personnel, and they were able to save his life. Wow. I know. Boston Police Officer Dennis Simmons was injured by a hand grenade and sadly died on April 10th, 2014. 15 other officers were also injured. A later report by Harvard Kennedy School's Program on Crisis Leadership concluded that lack of coordination among police agencies had put the public at excessive risk during the shootout. Which, low-key, I do agree, because, like, I know that they were trying to just follow behind and not engage, but, like, I don't know that they could have done anything different, but at the same time, I do kind of feel like that panic state and everybody, like, really wanting to catch these guys got in the way. A little bit. Only one firearm was recovered at the scene, which was one of the brothers' Ruger P95, which had a defaced serial number. So it was just scraped so they couldn't identify it. records on the Honda left at the scene identified the men as two brothers, because at this point, like, they visually knew what they looked like and knew they were the suspects but didn't know who they were. Mm-hmm. So they were two brothers whose family had migrated to the United States from Kyrgyzstan, seeking political asylum around 2002. Tamerlan was 26 years old at the time, and Zahar was 19. Oh, hold on. It tells you how to say his name this whole time. Zahar. I'm so sorry. Zahar. Zahar was 19. Not because I give a fuck about them, but because I do care about mispronouncing people's names. I wish I had one for the other brother, but I guess it is just Tamerlan. The FBI released additional photos of the two during the Watertown incident. And early on April 19th, Watertown residents received automated calls asking them to stay indoors. That same morning, Governor Patrick asked residents of Watertown and adjacent cities and towns to shelter in place. Somerville residents also received automated calls instructing them to shelter in place. A 20-block area of Watertown was cordoned off, and residents were told not to leave their homes or answer the door as officers scoured the area in tactical gear. So they literally went martial law on this 20-block area. Low-key, though, if it got me out of work, I'd be like, oh, no, martial law.
Oh, no.
But, like, when it's not convenient, I'm like, fuck out of here with your martial law.
Yeah.
But yes, if it got me out of work, I'd be like, oh shit, no, that martial law. So helicopters circled the area, SWAT teams in armored vehicles were going through in formation. Like, they were sweeping that 20 block radius. Like, they were inside of a building. Officers were going door to door searching houses. But also you told me not to answer the door. So, like,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, these actions generated discussions about the legality of searching large numbers of houses without a search warrant, with the Atlantic stating that this kind of search is legal due to exigent circumstances. Which bothers me, because exigent circumstances is an open-ended term.
It's just made up.
For such a thing.
That.
Correct. And my thing is, like, I get it. They're not in your house looking through your papers. Like, they're looking to see if, like, a fucking bombers hiding in your
yes.
closet, but right. still, it's
yeah.
my right to privacy, my right
mm-hmm.
to, it's my shit,
uh-huh.
it's my shit. Anyway, so, agencies on the scene with the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, Diplomatic Security Service, the National Guard, the Boston Cambridge, like, you get it, they're all there. The show of force was the first major field test of the interagency task forces created in the wake of September 11th. So, essentially, the Boston Marathon, which I didn't know, was the first time they ever physically enacted their emergency plans created in response to September 11th. So, it was a bit chaotic, but it's also why they were able to respond relatively quickly, although unorganized, which you have to anticipate a level of disorganization, because even without invite, you had all kinds of personnel just coming to help
mm-hmm.
that had, you know, guns, whatever. So it was a little bit of a Wild West, but yet somehow a little organized.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, that was a crisp cola. carrying on. The entire public transit network and most Boston taxi services were suspended, as was Amtrak service to and from Boston. So, literally no one was doing anything. They were like, not a single fucking soul is going anywhere. Correct. Logan International Airport did remain open under extremely heightened security. Universities, schools, many businesses, and other facilities were closed as thousands of law enforcement personnel participated in the door-to-door manhunt in Watertown. Others followed up on other leads, including searching the house that the brothers shared in Cambridge, where 7 improvised explosive devices were found. So they definitely had intentions of continuing on and harming a lot more people. The brother's father spoke from his home. I'm going to be 100%. I cannot say the name of this, but I'm going to do my absolute best. Makakala, Dagestan. Encouraging Jahar to give up, he said, quote, "Give up. You have a bright future ahead of you. Come home to Russia." He continued, "If they killed him, then all hell would break loose." On television, Jahar's uncle from Montgomery Village, Maryland, pleaded with him to turn himself in as well. So, I don't know what his dad meant about a bright future ahead of him. I think he meant if you can flee to Russia, they don't give a fuck, and you have a bright future here. Yeah. But I'm not clear on that, and that is speculation.
That's pretty wild.
Okay. On the evening of April 19th, 2 hours after the shelter-in-place order had been lifted, David Henneberry, a Watertown resident outside the search area, so outside of the 20 blocks, noticed that the tarp was loose on his parked boat. So he basically had a boat with a really tight-fitting, like, cover, mm-hmm. and the cover was loose. Kind of think of, like, how a pool cover is stretched out, and this mm-hmm. was, like, loose. Investigating, he saw a body lying inside the boat, and he saw a pool of blood. He immediately contacted the authorities who surrounded the boat, and a police helicopter verified movement through a thermal imaging device. Allegedly, the figure inside started poking at the tarp, prompting police to shoot at the boat. According to Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis and Watertown Police Chief DeVoe, Jahar was shooting at police from inside the boat, exchanging fire for an hour. A subsequent report indicated that the firing lasted for a shorter time, but despite both of these, Jahar was found to have no weapon on him when he was captured. And look, I'm not saying that I'm siding with somebody who has committed such a heinous act, but I'm just saying the rules are in place for a reason, and they should be kept consistently for all of us.
Yeah, no, they fake.
That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. No one panic. Jahar was arrested at 8:42 p.m. and taken to Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, where he was listed in critical condition. His injuries included gunshot wounds to the head, neck, legs, and hand. Initial reports that the neck wound represented a suicide attempt were contradicted by him being unarmed. So he couldn't have done it because he had nothing to do it with. The situation was chaotic, and according to a police source quoted by the Washington Post, and wait, what? It's a person's quote, but their quote doesn't make any fucking sense, so I'm trying to understand what I was trying to say. Basically, they said, this happened during the fog of war. It's not really the fog of war if only one side is warring. Mm-hmm. A subsequent review by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts provided this more specific summary. One officer fired his weapon without appropriate authority in response to perceived movement in the boat, and surrounding officers followed suit in a round of, air quotes, contagious fire, assuming they were being fired on by Jahar. Weapons continued to be fired for several seconds until unseen supervisors ordered a ceasefire and regained control of the scene. The unauthorized shots created another dangerous crossfire situation. Exactly. So, and that's the problem with taking it into your own hands. He was unarmed. He could have been taken peacefully. Instead, they opened fire. I get it. You're angry. Everybody's pissed, but you opened fire in a fucking person's backyard.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? There's dogs, there's kids, there's, like, fucking birds chirping in the trees and shit. Calm down. Calm down. And also, if he was armed, I don't think he'd be letting the owner of the house just be peeking in there and getting away with it. Okay, he's literally tried off everyone he's come into contact with and ran over his own brother. I don't think he cares about you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also, what the fuck is up with contagious fire? Like, accurate, but, like, the fuck? So, These confusions were caused in part by a lack of clearly identified and coordinated law enforcement command on the thousands of officers from some surrounding communities who self-deployed in the Watertown area during the events. So exactly like I said, from their perspective, they see you, you're a police officer, you're on our side, we're all in this together. No one was concerned that any Tom, Dick, or Harry from any agency had just come there because they wanted to be a part of it, and yeah. They didn't know anything. They didn't know anything. So, United States Senators, whatever, there's a bunch of them. The senator, John McCain was one of them. We know him. He ran for president. Mm-hmm. He was one of them. That's what you need to know. He was one of the senators who suggested that Jahar, a U.S. citizen, be tried as an unlawful enemy combatant rather than a criminal, potentially preventing him from obtaining legal counsel. Mm-hmm. This is important because basically what that means is exigent circumstances. Because we are mad, because you are not white, because of the situation, we would like to waive your right to counsel by basically saying you're committing domestic terrorism, essentially. So they didn't want him tried as a citizen. And the reason this was important to me is because, again, no excuses, but you do have to be devil's advocate when you're researching this stuff all the time. He's a 19-year-old kid who his main partner in crime was his brother, who he loved and looked up to. There was no real ties to them having, like, these political ties, so it kind of seems more like, I'm just saying not everything's black and white. That's the point. That's why these rules are in place, and basically these people were commissioning to say, no, fuck the rules. Fuck that. We want another exigent circumstance to not have to give him a fair chance. Me, I want to see you get the fair chance, and then the extra fair chance, because I want, when you go down, for it to feel real fucking salty and hard, yeah. But I also want to sleep at night knowing that you're the right person, that this is what happened, that right. We know all facts. Like, I want to snooze peacefully.
Fair enough.
That's all I'm saying. You know? But also, fuck this guy. Others said that doing so would be illegal, including prominent American legal scholar and lawyer Alan Dershowitz. And that it would jeopardize the prosecution. So they're arguing that if you do this, you're affecting, like, people are likely to be more lenient if they find him, like, if a juror finds him not guilty, they're going to be more lenient if they feel like you're throwing, like, these horrible things at him. If he does come in there and he's crying and he presents as, like, an innocent victim, like, you're fucking up the prosecution chances by, essentially, that's going to make him only eligible for certain things. Mm-hmm. The government ultimately decided to try Jahar in the federal criminal court system and not as an enemy combatant. So he was tried as just a U.S. citizen. He was questioned for 16 hours by investigators, but stopped communicating with them on the night of April 22nd after Judge Marion Fowler read him a Miranda warning. Jahar had not previously been given a Miranda warning, as federal law enforcement officials invoked the warnings public safety exception again. So this raised additional concerns. They never Mirandized him. They never read the rights. So ultimately, as soon as he was read his rights, he understood them and he stopped talking. So then it raised some concerns about, can anything he said up to this point even be admissible? So you're trying to use all these exigent circumstances, but they're there for a reason, because by doing this, you've now potentially threatened what we can use.
Right.
Because he could have literally, in that 16 hours, said, I killed everyone, I did it all by myself, and they can't do shit about it if they didn't make him properly aware. So that was a whole other thing. And you'll see, unfortunately, that theme continues. I mean, I personally feel good about how it ends up, ultimately, but anyway. Yeah, so then there was a whole debate about Miranda rights in general, so that caused a whole fucking uproar, and everybody was getting hot about that. On April 22nd, 2013, formal criminal charges were brought against him in the United States District Court during a bedside hearing, because he was still hospitalized, because he did have some very extensive injuries. He was charged with use of a weapon of mass destruction, malicious destruction of property resulting in death. Some of the charges carry potential sentences of life imprisonment or even the death penalty. He was judged to be awake, mentally competent, and lucid, and he responded to most questions by nodding. The judge asked him whether he was able to afford an attorney, and he said no, so he was represented by the Federal Public Defender's Office. On April 26th, Jahar was moved from the hospital to the Federal Medical Center at Fort Devens, about 40 miles away. And it's basically a prison hospital. It's a federal prison medical facility at a former Army base. And at this point, he was placed on solitary confinement, segregated housing, and had 23 hours a day lockdown. So he was completely by himself and, again, no access to anyone or anything. And that's the point. The point is, if you can put me in a position to empathize with him, you're putting a juror in a position to empathize with him. That's why it matters. That's why. If I can see some jerk who blew up a bunch of people and then was treated with the utmost letter of the law, and then I'm like, yeah, you're fucking guilty. But if I'm going to sit there and be like, oh no, he didn't have anything or anyone, or man, they didn't even get him, you know, this or that, then I'm going to start to, like, the seed's going to start to be in there. I'm a person. I've done good and bad. Like, that's how that happens. It's important. Okay. That's all I'm saying. I'm also mad because this was on July 10th, the day before my birthday, and that's rude. So, on July 10th, 2013, he pleaded not guilty to 30 charges in the first public court appearance, including a murder charge for MIT police officer Sean Collier. He was back in court for a status hearing on September 23rd, and his lawyers requested more time to prepare the defense. On October 2nd, Jahar's attorneys asked the court to lift the special administration measures imposed by Attorney General Holder in August. Again, special administrative measures, saying that the measures had left Jahar unduly isolated from communication with his family and lawyers, and that no evidence suggested that he posed a future threat, meaning he is in prison, he has no way of getting out, there's no evidence to support that he's in contact with any, like, groups or cells, only his brother. So why is he, like, truly not able to speak to anyone? And as they mentioned, even his legal counsel. So jury selection began on January 5th, 2015, and was completed on March 3rd with a jury consisting of 8 men and 10 women, including 6 alternates. Basically, they were trying to paint Jahar as a soldier in a holy war against Americans whose motive was reaching paradise. And the defense attorney called the brothers equal participants. You know, the one brother's dead, so of course they want to try to shift as much of the blame over there as they can. The defense attorney, Judy Clark, did admit that Jahar had placed the second bomb and was present at the murder of Sean Collier, the carjacking of Dunmang, and the Watertown shootout, but she emphasized the influence that his older brother had on him, portraying him as a follower. Between March 4th and March 30th, prosecutors called more than 90 witnesses, including bombing survivors who described losing their limbs in the attack, and the government rested its case on March 30th. The defense rested as well on March 31st after calling 4 witnesses. Jahar was found guilty on all 30 counts on April 8th, and the sentencing phase of the trial began on April 21st. A further verdict was reached on May 15th, in which it was recommended that he be put to death, and Jahar was sentenced to death on June 14th after apologizing to the victims. In 2018, his lawyers appealed on the grounds that a lower court judge's refusal to move the case to another city, not traumatized by the bombings, deprived him of a fair trial, which I also understand. Mm-hmm. On July 30th, 2020, his death sentence was reversed by the United States Court of Appeals, which found that during jury selection, the district court did not properly screen prospective jurors on how much they had heard about the case. Okay. Yep. The first Circuit vacated the death sentence and three of the other 30 convictions against Jahar and ordered a new penalty phase jury trial with fresh jurors, leaving the decision of a new change of venue to the district court. His remaining convictions still carried multiple life sentences, ensuring that he would remain in prison regardless of the results of the new trial. However, the United States government appealed the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2021, which basically finished, and on March 4th, 2022, the Supreme Court reversed the decision of the First Circuit and reinstated the death penalty. So, it went back and forth, but he received the death penalty. So, as I mentioned, three people were killed as a direct result of the bombings. So, Crystal Marie Campbell, who was a 29-year-old restaurant manager from Medford, Massachusetts, was killed by the first bomb. Liu Lingzi, a 23-year-old Chinese national and Boston University statistics graduate, statistics graduate student from Shenyang, and an 8-year-old child named Martin William Richard from the Dorchester neighborhood of Boston. And the second two were both killed by the second bomb. Mm-hmm. So Crystal by the first and the other two by the second. Then, as I mentioned, Sean Allen Collier, who was the 27-year-old police officer who was shot and killed by the bomber sitting in his car. He had been with the police department only since 2006. He died from multiple gunshot wounds. And then the police officer, Dennis Simmons, who got hit by the partial grenade, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. He died on April 10th, 2014. His was actually from head injuries he received during the shootout the year before. So he lived for about a year after.
Wow.
About 281 civilians were treated at 27 hospitals, like I mentioned. 11 days later, 29 remained hospitalized, one in critical condition. Many victims had lower leg injuries and shrapnel wounds, which indicated that the devices were low to the ground. At least 16 civilians lost limbs at the scene or by surgical amputation, and three lost more than one limb, including the gentleman who was able to give the description, who lost both of his legs. Doctors described removing ball-bearing type metallic beads a little larger than BBs and small carpenter type nails about 0.5 to 1 inch in length. Similar objects were found at the scene, so basically they packed these bombs full of these sharp objects and they exploded and sent like shrapnel. The New York Times cited doctors as saying the bombs mainly injured legs, ankles, and feet because they were low to the ground, instead of fatally injuring abdomens, chest, shoulders, and heads. Some victims had perforated eardrums as well. MBTA police officer Richard Donahue Jr. was critically wounded. He was the one wounded during a firefight, who had his artery severed. He lost almost all of his blood and his heart stopped for 45 minutes, during which time he was kept alive by cardiopulmonary resuscitation, like manual resuscitation. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty quickly reported that he was hit by a fellow officer. Mark Fucarelli lost his right leg and received severe burns and shrapnel wounds, and he was the last victim released from the hospital on July 24th, 2013. There was, unfortunately, rising anti-Muslim sentiment online and locally in the weeks following the bombing, causing distress in the local Muslim community and making some afraid to leave their homes. Numerous sporting events, concerts, and other public entertainment were postponed or canceling. Basically, there was a national and even international response, an outflowing of support, resources. It went on and on. I wrote it all out here and then realized y'all don't need to hear about all that. They did a lot of things to honor everyone. They have all of the things that were donated to the, like memorials kept in like a safe location where they're not going to get damaged. So they've taken a lot of care. I'm just deciding if any of the rest of this is something you guys will care about, and I'm feeling a strong no. I'm feeling a strong no. This is a long episode. We've been through a lot. Basically, I'm going to let you off the hook and say you've been here long enough. So, yes, he received the death penalty again. That's where we are. That's all I know. The Boston Marathon, they've recovered and recuperated and supported one another. It still goes on today, thankfully.
Mm-hmm. It's fucking great, too.
And we've been through a lot, so we're going to go. You heard me tell that story. Just reliving that story took it all out of me. I couldn't recover after that. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.